Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Rebecca Lavoie in for Virginia Prescott. Coming up today, the science behind telepathic rats. We'll find out why rodents have been wired to share their thoughts and whether this is a first step in our own journey toward the Vulcan mind meld. We'll also hear about the fight against corporations for our genomic liberty. If you've got DNA, you should probably pay attention. And a filmmaker follows a tribe of Brooklynites who fill their pantry from the dumpsters of Trader Joe's. We'll talk about the logistics and philosophy behind foraging in the trash for free food. But we begin with a story that gives new meaning to the word resolve. Last month marked the second anniversary of the nuclear disaster and subsequent evacuation of Fukushima, Japan. But one man, Naoto Matsumura, is defying government orders and living by himself inside the zone.
It was crazy at first. No lights, no sound. The first week, I was uneasy. It was too quiet.
Naoto is a 53-year-old fifth-generation rice farmer who returned to Fukushima not long after the disaster first unfolded and discovered thousands of abandoned farm animals and pets surviving in the area despite high doses of radiation. Vice Japan's Ivan Kovach is director and editor of Alone in the Zone, a documentary that follows Naoto on his days caring for the animals of Fukushima. We reached him in Tokyo via Skype. Ivan, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you very much.
Tell us about Naoto. Why is he in the zone? What motivates him to be there?
After the nuclear reactor at Fukushima Daiichi exploded, he feared for his life. He tried to escape. But the first thing he encountered was opposition from his direct family. They basically didn't want to take him in because they thought he was too, toxic, that he had too much radiation on him, that it would kind of infect their house. That pissed him off and he left. And then he went to an evacuation center and they didn't take him in either because they said it was too full. Too many refugees. You got to fend for yourself. And mind you, this is right after the disaster when everything was in utter chaos. And after that, he said, well, nobody wants me. I'm just going to go back home. I've got no choice. So he went back to his home, and that's when he realized nobody had fed their animals at all. Everyone just fled, as you would in that situation. And, you know, he started feeding his own animals, then his neighbor's animals. And the evolution of his thought regarding these animals developed from that point on.
Well, let's talk about that evolution. There is a policy in place to, it was first to let the animals fend for themselves, and then there was a mass slaughter of the animals ordered by officials there. Where is he right now in terms of that slaughter? He doesn't want it to happen. And these aren't animals that can be used for, you know, feeding people. These animals are basically toxic.
He's rescued all the animals he can. He's only got so many resources as well, so he clearly can't do the whole of that part of Fukushima. But he's doing the best job that he can. And he simply doesn't see the point in having this cattle slaughtered. He understands, you know, the nature of life, you know, the food chain. He admits to that in the movie, but to senselessly slaughter animals for no reason other than that they have some cesium and can't be used as food for people, he just sees that as unbelievable. There are also cats and dogs that he has been feeding since day one, and of course he has a couple of pet ostriches, which were ironically the pets of TEPCO, the Daiichi reactor. It was a team bonding project at the reactor, and after the tsunami hit, they freed the ostriches because they thought they couldn't take care of them. And in a strange turn of fate, Naoto took two of their ostriches in and gave them a home.
Now, he's completely alone in this zone, correct?
That's correct. As far as we know, he's one of the only people living within that 20K zone. There may be others, but it's hard to kind of track them down. They're probably most likely elderly people who don't really have much contact with anyone and who are not as vocal as him.
Is it legal for him to be there?
It's a legal gray zone. Technically, it's not legal for reasons, you know, I guess, for his personal well-being that I won't explain. He's worked out a way around that, which is why he can pass freely in and out of the gates.
Let's talk about Naoto's health. He is absorbing a tremendous amount of radiation. How is his health and how does he feel about the risk?
His health is fine. He does have a lot of radiation in his system, and it will inevitably damage his cells and potentially greatly increase the risk of him getting cancer. But as he points out, he'll probably the cigarettes, the tobacco that he smokes a pack and a half a day, the tobacco and the Japanese sake will probably get him before the radiation does. That's not to say that radiation is harmless. It's definitely not. For him, it's more important doing what he's doing than, I guess, his own eventual demise because of an increased risk of cancer.
He really is living the life, and we've seen it in film before, of sort of one person alone in a post-apocalyptic landscape. You were there with your crew. Can you describe what it's like to follow him through his day?
It's a strange... I should probably start off a bit, even a bit earlier than that. When you enter the zone, as we call it in English, the no-go zone, the evacuated zone, you have to pass through a checkpoint at the Fukushima Daini nuclear reactor. That's the one that didn't explode, which is right next to the one that exploded. And employees of that reactor actually give you radiation suits, hazmat suits and masks and covers for your shoes, multiple pairs and all kinds of gloves. They whop a Geiger counter around you to see the dose of radiation that you get. Then you enter the zone and everything's gone. There's nothing there. The streets are overgrown with grass. Nature has reclaimed everything. You know, there's a Geiger counter on every corner for some unknown reason. You know that it's toxic, but it's there and it's not really warning anybody. Then you hit Naoto's place and he's there standing in his regular day-to-day clothes. He's combed his hair for the interview and he's got a big smile on his face and he smokes a cigarette. And it's a strange reality when you confront all of this. Then as you follow him throughout his day, you slowly grow to realize why he does what he does. He sees these animals as his friends more than it being an animal rights movement, which he actually jokes about in our movie. When he's playing with his ostrich, he wonders if he actually rode the ostrich, would the animal rights movement people think he's abusing this ostrich? He really just cares for these animals and sees it as his friends and just wants to do what's right. It's a simple mentality, but it's a really, I think, an honorable way of viewing the world.
But he seems so lonely. I mean, he's surrounded by all of these living creatures, but I mean, that really is the feeling that pervades the whole film, is that he is so deeply, deeply lonely.
He lives a lonely life. His only human contact in the zone is perhaps the occasional cleanup worker or person who works at the reactor. He has his iPad and his cell phone, and I guess that's his main contact with the outside world, unless he actually goes outside to get more feed for his animals and re-enter.
What has reaction been like now that his story is out there? How are people around the world, you know, sort of feeling about him and his situation? Has he been in contact with those people?
He understands English, but he doesn't speak it very well. So that's maybe a slight problem. But he does have a friend in the United States who started a Facebook group, I guess, in his honor. That was actually one of my first contacts when I started doing this project. But people's reaction around the world is it's been interesting. There have been, of course, people who thought the movie was biased against nuclear energy and nuclear power. But then, ironically, there's been people who watched the movie and said the exact opposite thing. You weren't strongly enough against nuclear power or nuclear energy. The ironic thing in the end is that this film was not about nuclear energy at all. It was about two men whose lives have been affected by a tragedy, and their opinions are what shape this story, not mine.
Will people ever be able to return to this part of Japan?
I think one day, maybe in our lifetimes, we'll see people move back in all the way, but that's a long way from now.
Well, Ivan, thank you so much for joining us and sharing the story with us.
No worries. Thank you for having me.
Ivan Kovac, director and editor of the documentary film Alone in the Zone. You can find a link to the film, definitely worth watching, on our Facebook page, Word of Mouth Radio. And special thanks to the film's executive producer and head of Vice Magazine's Japan Bureau, Akiko Kuramatsu, for setting up this interview. More than 25 years after the death of former dictator Enver Hoxha, Albania has more concrete bunkers than it knows what to do with. Hulking relics of a bygone era, the forgotten structures number around 750,000. That's one bunker for every four Albanian citizens. The process of bunkerization, which lasted Hoxha's entire 40-year rule, has fascinated historians but remained as obscure to the rest of the world as Albania itself. David Gullhard is hoping to change that. He's a photographer and author of the award-winning photo book Concresco, which paints a portrait of Albania and its landscape of historic paranoia. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Tell us the story of these bunkers. Why were they built?
At a certain point, Albania, or at least Enver Hoxha, decided to apart from Big Brother Russia, and he broke with the Warsaw Pact. And at that point, he was afraid that actually that the country would be invaded by either the East or the West Front. He figured that it was best that Albanian people would be able to defend their own country.
Well, let's just talk about the number and where they are. They number 24 to every square kilometer. There's, like I said, one for every four citizens of the country. What does the landscape look like there? Can you just describe it for us?
Actually, it's a really beautiful landscape. Albania is a beautiful country. You have a lot of different kind of landscape in such a small surface. But if you drive through it, you see these bunkers pop up everywhere. And most of them are actually on the close to the borders. But even inside of the country, you have plains just covered with bunkers, and also in the mountains.
Looking at the bunkers, they're dome-shaped. Some of them are partially buried, but they're kind of crumbling. I'm wondering if there have been any makeshift uses for these bunkers now that they've been stripped of their original purpose.
Directly after the fall of communism in 1991, the country was already quite poor. 80% of all the money from the country was spent on military purposes. So there were no houses built, no roads built. And after the fall of communism, people started to use the bunkers as a home or to begin a small shop, like it could be a tattoo shop or to grow mushrooms in them or make a cafeteria. So they are still sort of used.
What is the size range? Is there enough room inside of one to make a home or a business?
You have three kinds of bunkers. You have the really small ones. I can barely stand in them. Then you have a bigger size, which is also a dome. And those are quite good for making a small shop. And you have a certain kind of bunker that is built into the mountains. So you have a tunnel going into the mountains and a concrete platter, I think is the word, in front of that. And those actually can be used to build a home.
Are locals in Albania at all fond of these bunkers? Do they have a cultural or aesthetic or even a historic value for the people there?
I think for most people they don't, but it really depends on who you speak to. I have some interviews in the book with military, well, actually they were professors, but they trained people to fight in these bunkers. And those two men think that all the bunkers should be sort of adopted as monuments. But there's also a man who helped to build the bunkers. And there's actually one on his land, and he's a farmer. And it's really in the way of doing his work. He has to go around it. So it's for him, it doesn't really work. And he would like to see them all removed. But he has to pay for it himself.
Now, your book, Concresco, does expose this part of history. You have some incredible photographs of these bunkers and the people of Albania. But you've said that you're trying to tell a story about that country. What story are you trying to tell with the photos of these bunkers?
Well, the interesting thing with Albania is that for a long time, it was really an eastern country. It was behind the curtain. But now they're looking really towards the west, to the west of Europe, of course, because they're sort of attached right on the border of Western Europe and also to America. But they still carry this dictatorial history with them. And you really notice that with one foot, they're still in the east and with the other one in the west. And that sort of splits up the country and makes it hard for them to form their own identity. So they're in sort of a transition stage. And I think that is a really interesting stage of a country to focus on.
You've said that Concresco, your book, is not Albania, but it's your vision of Albania. What is that vision now after visiting there and taking these photos?
It's much more than the country that I thought I knew. When you're in Holland and you hear anything about Albania, it's probably bad. You hear about women trafficking, cars being stolen from Germany. So all the little slices of news you hear are negative. And like so many other countries, if you visit the country, you will find a completely different country than you think you know. I found a country that is extremely beautiful, has lovely people who helped me make this book and were proud to show me their country and were proud that somebody was interested in showing it to other people. That is something that I also wanted to show to a bigger crowd, that it's not only the poor Albania with all the negative news you hear about.
David Halyard is a photographer and author of the award-winning photo book Concresco. We reached him in the Netherlands via Skype. David, thanks so much for joining us.
No problem. Thank you.
We've posted links to more on the book, including a slideshow of some of David's photos taken of Albania's many abandoned bunkers at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, lab rats wired for telepathy. That's right. We'll get that story when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Rebecca Lavoie, in for Virginia Prescott.
Minds are merging, Doctor. Our minds are one. I feel what you feel. I know what you know.
That's Leonard Nimoy, of course, as Mr. Spock in Star Trek, transferring his thoughts into the brain of Dr. McCoy. Impossible science fiction, right? Well, maybe not. Recently, we came across a story about scientists creating telepathic rats in a lab at Duke University. On the line from London to tell us more is Douglas Heaven, who wrote about the experiment for New Scientist magazine. Douglas, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. Hello.
Okay, so as I understand it, this creation of telepathic rats involves putting electrodes in the brains of two groups of rats. Can you explain the groups and how it all worked?
Yeah, sure. So as you say, two groups of rats. One group were called the encoders and one group were called the decoders. Beforehand, all these rats were trained to press a lever, like when a light went on above the lever. If they pressed it, they'd get a little reward, some water or some juice or something. And then they were split into these two groups, as you said, and then only the first group, the encoders, were shown the light, and the second group were given no sort of visual cue at all. But they were still able to press the correct lever using the brain signals transferred down a wire from the first encoding set of rats.
How accurate was the telepathy between the two groups?
Well, I think it got up to around between 60 and 70%. So this wasn't sort of foolproof, but I mean, that's really significant. It's way above sort of just trial and error. I think sort of the best group, after they sort of got a bit used to it, were up to sort of 72% of the time. And there are also improvements, like as the rats got used to the setup, they performed better. I think the rats that were encoding the signal, in a way, almost, when I spoke to the lead researcher, he said that they perhaps concentrated better, because when their partner rats got it right, they were given an additional reward, which sort of encouraged them to encode their signals better, if that makes sense.
It does. They were encouraged to be more telepathic.
Yeah, exactly.
So the thing that I found so fascinating was that it wasn't even like proximity mattered. It wasn't the rats were even in the same lab. At one point, they had rats that were very far apart, right?
Yeah, that was one of the crazier aspects. I mean, that was just to demonstrate that, as you say, these don't need to be close together. I mean, they sent it between a lab in Brazil with one rat up to the university in Duke, just over the regular internet, which is nuts when you think about it.
This isn't the first time animals have been implanted with these kinds of electrodes. Monkeys, their brains have been wired to control robots, for example. But is this the first brain-to-brain connection?
Yeah, it is, in terms of actually having electrodes implanted and you know, the signal from one brain going directly into the second brain. Yeah, it's the first time.
You wrote about the reaction of the scientific community to this work. How are other researchers reacting to it?
Well, to be honest, it's quite mixed. I mean, it's a crazy experiment, and it captures, you know, everyone's imagination, and you know, the Spock reference is right on. But you know, some people think this is really great and an amazing sort of scientific breakthrough. Others, you know, a little less sure of the sort of the immediate benefits of it. I mean, in a sense, you do have to put your hands up and say, you know, what does this show us, and what was the point of it? I mean, I think some people have even been as critical as saying, you know, this was just a stunt and it gets great publicity, but, you know, what's the use ultimately?
Well, you do write about the possibility of humans being connected maybe to insects or animals for maybe military sort of live animal drones or sort of.
Yeah.
But anyone think that maybe we could someday be able to transmit more abstract thoughts than just pulling a lever or navigating through a rat tunnel?
Yeah, well, I personally think that's a real possibility. And some of the people I spoke to think that's certainly where we're headed. I mean, at the moment, it's relatively crude. I mean, this is an amazing scientific achievement. You know, no one's done it before. But we still don't know what the content, if you like, of these brain signals are. You know, we saw some pattern appear in one rat and we sent that over to the other rat. So we're not sort of deciphering it. But we're learning every week. We learn more things. And so we get better at understanding exactly what's going on in the brain and how that might relate to, you know, things like abstract thoughts. So some people I spoke to certainly think that, you know, one day it'll be possible to transfer these kinds of things.
Douglas Heaven is a reporter covering technology and biomedicine. He wrote about some incredible research at Duke University creating a telepathic connection between rats for New Scientist magazine. Douglas, thank you so much for joining us.
No, you're welcome. It's a pleasure.
We've posted a link to his article on our Facebook page, as well as that clip from Star Trek we played earlier. That episode, of course, was Mirror, Mirror, so technically that wasn't the Mr. Spock we know and love, but rather his alternate universe twin. You know, the one with the goatee.
I shall not waste time with you. You're too inflexible, too disciplined once you've made up your mind.
You're running a big risk, Spock.
I have the phaser, Captain, and I do not intend to simply disappear as so many of your opponents have in the past.
And now for a medical story that sounds like something from a dystopian science fiction plot, the fight for genomic liberty. That's right, you don't own your own genes. Over 40,000 patents on DNA molecules have been submitted by private research companies, essentially claiming the entire human genome sequence for profit. The Supreme Court will review the matter at a hearing on April 15th, and the outcome could have significant impact on personalized medicine and scientific research. Joining us is Dr. Christopher Mason of Weill Cornell Medical College's Department of Physiology and Biophysics. He's co-author of a new study that got our attention on the issue of genomic liberty. Dr. Mason, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
So patenting genes, who is doing the patenting here and what do they stand to gain from it?
So the patents come from actually thousands of different companies. Some of them even come from universities like the University of California, mainly because researchers at these institutions, as they do their research, as soon as they patent something, it goes to the university. But there are a lot of companies you'd be familiar with, like Myriad Genetics is one that's notorious in this case, the BRCA1 or breast cancer gene case. But it includes other companies like Monsanto, Insight, Pfizer, Lilly, usually a normal range of pharmaceutical companies.
Are they patenting the entire human genome sequence or more specific pieces of it?
So we usually see particular genes patented or sub-portions of these different genes analysis. We decided to look at both these large genes, these sort of full gene patents, as well as short nucleotide or short sequence patents.
Walk us through your testing and your research to determine the potential ramifications of these fragment patents.
So I started on this subject because as I was doing research in neurogenetics and cancer genomics, you often don't know what gene is the most likely culprit for your disease or which combinations of genes. And so we often have to look at tens of genes, hundreds of genes at a time to find mutations or aberrations or problems with these different genes. And there was a paper published actually in 2005 that indicated that as many as 18% of human genes were patented, which got my attention then because it seemed strange that genes were patented. And as I looked closer at the issue, it turned out a lot of their analysis was mostly right. But what was strange is more patents kept getting issued, and there have been patents increasing in number every year since really the early 1980s on DNA. If I was just doing my normal research in my laboratory where I look at a gene and I isolate it and try and sequence it or examine mutations in that gene as a geneticist, I would almost unavoidably be infringing somebody's patent. And so it got me thinking about what else might be patented in these longer as well as shorter sequence patents. And so in our analysis, we looked essentially at long sequence patents, which we estimate cover about 40% of all the genes. But we also looked at this more very broad class of patents that's called, you know, short sequence patents, or as small as 15 nucleotides or 15 letters, or some even 14 or 13 letters. And we found that actually, if you look at the summary of all these very short patents, all of the genes in the human genome, as well as most of the other areas outside of genes, have been patented because of the very vague language of the patents, where they'll say something like, we patent any molecule with only 15 letters of our gene. So that includes hundreds or in some cases thousands of genes with just one patent.
You mentioned something early on there, personalized medicine, which we have talked in the program about. That's doctors using patients' own genes to fight specific types of cancer, for instance. What does it mean for those patients and those doctors if this continues, if all of these genes are patented? What does it mean for us?
So in that case, it really restricts to some degree what I like to say is your genomic liberty, where you have the ability to look at your DNA, or if you want to give, you know, your cells to your doctor and say, please look for mutations in genes that are, you know, look for ovarian cancer genes or breast cancer genes or prostate cancer genes, please look for mutations in these genes. And in often cases, the doctor can still order the test, but they can only order it from one place, and they can't get a second opinion from a different place, or they can't try a new test that might reveal other treatment options if it's on one gene. And more importantly, as we pointed out in our paper, that, you know, cancer genes don't often just apply to one type of cancer. So whereas, you know, these companies really got a particular patent to look at, say, just breast cancer or just prostate cancer, but cancer genes are often mutated in all types of cancer from all across the body. And so they actually are restricting research on more than one type of cancer by targeting just patent on one cancer.
We're talking about your genes and the companies that hold patents on them. Our guest is Dr. Christopher Mason of the Weill Cornell Medical College. He's co-author of a new study on the issue of genomic liberty. And that's a very interesting term. Can you just define genomic liberty for us?
Yes, I'd say it is the innate right of every person to examine his or her own DNA or to do things with it that he or she might like. You know, some people are very private with their medical information, but some people like to share their genetic information, which often reveals, say, your medical information with, say, their family members. But it's your right to do what you want with your genetic information. And so some people are very private, but some are very public because they want to share this information to help their family members. Or even some patients who've actually posted their entire genome online because they just are good citizens and want to help the field progress forward. So that, I think, is within the realm of your liberty. Also, you should be able to sequence your own DNA. You should be able to look at your own DNA and do different chemical reactions on your DNA.
You mentioned the innate right, and we know there's this upcoming Supreme Court hearing on this issue. What are they going to be looking at the Supreme Court?
So they're specifically looking at whether or not these patents that have been claimed on the BRCA1 or breast cancer-associated genes should have been ever granted when they were in the mid-90s. So they're going to be examining whether they should be taken down, and that then means anyone should be able to sequence the BRCA1 genes or other genes important for disease, or if they're upheld, and then basically then that means each company holds sway over different parts of your genome.
What would be the ideal ruling? I mean, is there middle ground for both individual liberty, scientific innovation, and these companies to be incentivized to continue doing this research that's led to these patents?
Yeah, I think there definitely could be a middle ground, and there's even been some legislative history that parallels this. Actually, it used to be that you could patent surgical techniques. This was done in the early 90s, but it created an uproar because the American Medical Association thought it was patently ridiculous, if you can pardon the bad joke, that you could patent a specific surgical technique and that you would hold hostage a better surgical technique to someone who is in need of it just because someone hadn't paid a license fee. So the compromise that happened was the United States Congress put into the code that you can still get a patent on a surgical technique, but that people who use it are not liable for their infringing of that patent. So you can still claim yourself as the inventor, but other people don't have to always pay you royalties for the best surgical technique. And in that case, it meant that there was some of it a balance between, you know, intellectual property recognition, but also making sure that patients get the best medical care.
Dr. Christopher Mason, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
He's assistant professor in the Department of Physiology and Biophysics at Cornell University's Weill Medical College and co-author of a startling study on genomic liberty. You can read more about the study and the upcoming Supreme Court case at wordofmouthradio.org. Of medicine isn't all bleak, especially when it comes to the introduction of robots to improve surgical techniques. That being said, hospitals aren't always willing to be early adopters of untested robotic tools. NHPR's Todd Bookman found one New Hampshire hospital who recently took that high-tech leap, hoping to ease pain for surgeons and their patients.
It's been 2 weeks since Bonnie Parker had her hip replaced.
No numbness or tingling in the feet or anything?
No, not at all.
Okay.
She's in for a checkup with her orthopedist from Lakes Region General Hospital. Parker is 50, petite, a tattoo artist. So she's no stranger to pain, but says the past few years have been really tough.
And I watched my mother suffer from arthritis and sat down one day and never got back up. And, you know, I found myself sitting down more and more and not getting up. And I thought, no, I can't do this.
After non-surgical solutions failed to help, Parker spoke with her doctor and decided to try a new robot-assisted procedure, something called Makoplasty.
This is a wonderful opportunity to show my parents that all that time spent playing video games was time well spent.
Dr. Jeremy Hogan is maneuvering a robotic arm that's got basically a small drill as its finger. The entire machine is about the size of a shopping cart. The arm itself isn't remote controlled. Hogan's hand actually moves the appendage. He demonstrates on a plastic knee.
So then hopefully I did a reasonable job here. It said I passed, so that's good.
Hip and partial knee replacements involve cutting away damaged bone and replacing it with an artificial joint, usually a metal alloy. During a Makoplasty surgery, the robotic arm is connected to a 3D scan of the joint and an infrared camera. By watching a screen, Dr. Hogan can remove the exact amount of bone. The drill turns itself off if he goes too far. Then he can place the implant with improved accuracy.
The device doesn't think. It doesn't walk in and do the surgery by itself. It only does what we tell it. So ultimately, its success is based on a good operative plan, but it does allow us to execute the plan that we've designed with very high level precision.
To within a fraction of a millimeter, better, Hogan says, than most surgeons can do with just their eyes. That can reduce recovery time and the risk of future complications. Good news for patients, and Lakes Region General Hospital hopes good for business. Joanne Lamphere says that's a possibility. She's a consultant with Health Management Associates, which works with hospitals around the country.
Hospitals, if they invest in a winner, they can attract top doctors. They can attract a higher volume of patients.
Specifically older patients who, if they have a good experience, may return for future procedures. Lakes Region invested just under $1 million in the robot. But by being the only hospital north of Boston with the technology, it hopes to market itself as the go-to place for knee and hip work in the region. And it's doing just that, with brochures and traveling information sessions. Lamphere says there is a risk, though.
It's sort of like a 60-year-old divorced man buying a red Ferrari to lure dates.
So it might work.
It might work, but it might also be a very expensive boondoggle.
She says it's too soon to know. Robotic technology has come into mainstream use within just the past decade or so. Only 150 hospitals are currently using Mako. The most popular surgical robot, the Da Vinci system, has sold more than 2,500 worldwide. But there are numerous lawsuits currently pending against its manufacturer, claiming injuries and complications. Dr. Sherry Gleed of Columbia University researches robotics and healthcare. She says the machines are tested for safety, but unlike, say, a new prescription drug, they aren't confirmed to be more effective.
People are really excited about robots, and they look cool, but we really don't know whether they work any better, and they might even work worse.
For Bonnie Parker, the short-term results of her Makoplasty surgery are anything but inferior.
Everything I felt with the arthritis is like magically gone.
Dr. Jeremy Hogan looks over her x-rays and says her new hip is positioned right where he wants it. Lakes Region General Hospital hopes it's also positioned to benefit from its new device. For Word of Mouth, I'm Todd Bookman.
can find more on that Makoplasty surgery and other news about robots in the OR at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, dumpster diving for dinner. We'll find out what that tastes like when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Rebecca Lavoie. Just about everyone who's ever shopped at the grocery store has instinctively checked produce for bruising or blemishes or put aside a can of beans just because it was dented. But there are a lot of people willing to eat for free what paying customers will not, even if they have to dig through a dumpster to find it.
You know, don't be afraid to grab the yogurt. Don't be afraid to grab the sushi. Don't be afraid to grab the cheese. If you hesitate just a second, it's gone.
New Hampshire native Alex Malice is head of Analect Films and the director of the short documentary Spoils, Extraordinary Harvest. The film follows a diverse group of so-called dumpster divers on their late-night journey to a New York City Trader Joe's. Alex, you followed several different dumpster divers in your film. What qualities or beliefs did they share, and how were they different from one another?
They actually came from quite a wide range of political or apolitical beliefs. You know, a lot of people associate dumpster diving with this so-called freeganism, which is a fiercely political ideology that sort of speaks to the idea that by living off the excess of society, you're making a political statement about the waste that we generate. Almost all the people I followed, you know, they didn't explicitly talk about that, and they were more just interested in the free food. They were saying, "Hey, if there's free food, I want it."
What about their income levels? Are these all people who need to get free food, or are these people who could be buying groceries?
Yeah, every single person, both in the film and people that I met that didn't appear on camera, could certainly get by without this free food. There, you know, I actually didn't really come across any homeless people or people who couldn't otherwise survive. And beyond that, you know, the income levels were quite diverse. There was people who were on, you know, certainly on the lower end of the income level, and there was people who certainly had a lot of money.
One of the people you follow really defies stereotype. He's clean cut. He has a nice apartment. Here he is showing the camera just a few of the treasure food products he's found in a dumpster.
Pasta from Italy. This is my walnuts, beautiful cashews, just like a dent in the can. This is the finest Dijon mustard I've ever had in my life. Wild Alaskan salmon. This I got last night. This is a nice find. It's got a crack in it. It's sea salt, peanut butter.
When you see this food in a pantry and away from a trash can, it's hard not to acknowledge what a waste it would have been to throw it all away. I have that very container of sea salt, for example, in my pantry. What are people sacrificing, though, when they eat this food from dumpsters?
I think the biggest sacrifice is time, actually. In the film, it's all sped up, and you know the film is only 20 minutes long, and you get this whole process summarized. But in reality, you have to leave your home at 10:30 p.m. and you get out there, and you might end up waiting around. It's not exact, and then you have to actually do the dumpster diving, which could take 30, 40 minutes. Then you have to go home, and then you have to wash it, and the whole process can take, you know, 4 or even 5 hours, depending on the kind of night. So, you know, as opposed to going to the grocery store where you're in and out and you pick what you want and that's that, it's actually quite a lot of time.
Can you describe the typical dumpster diving session? How many people were there? What time of day is it? All that stuff?
It really depends on the store, and this is constantly changing. There's really no golden rule. But generally, it's after hours. 30 minutes after the store closes, they'll gather their, you know, the day's trash and they'll bring it out. This usually happens around 11 p.m., sometimes midnight. It can look like, oh, nobody's here tonight. But then as soon as these dumpsters are rolled out, 20 people come out of the woodwork, you know, out of cars, around the corner, you know, descend from helicopters. It's like they come from everywhere, and suddenly there's 20 or 30 people there.
Is that?
Oh, we got tomatoes and
blueberries and strawberries!
No, these are the, what's the name of that? I know that. They're like oranges. Get me the bag. No, they're red, they're green bag. On the front.
Oh, there's more potatoes.
That one. That has something in? Okay, so here. Oh, mandarins, yeah.
You know, one of the characters in the film sort of describes it as a free-for-all, and in many ways it is, but it's also very, for the most part, it's a very egalitarian process. People are sort of like, ooh, you know, okay, here's a bag of potatoes, I'll take what I need, and then sort of announce, does anybody need any potatoes? Or, oh, here's, you know, in the film some guy says, oh, cat food, but I don't have a cat, does anybody want this? You know, despite the fact that I think people come from quite different backgrounds. You know, there's people who I've seen there who don't even really speak English, or there's people, you know, these hipsters or these grandmothers and young people and middle-aged people, and no one really makes small talk, but they all sort of understand that they're there for the same reason, and there's this excitement that we're all doing something amazing, something secret, and something a little under the radar that we're all benefiting greatly from. And it's like, it's almost like a big joke. You know, you pull out these high-end organic, you know, packaged foods, and you're saying, what the hell, look at this. This is like, you know, I just pulled out a $20 hunk of cheese, and I'm just going to take this for free.
Oh, there's so much cheese!
Okay, I'm here.
All right, what do you want, double cream French?
No,
pita bread, cheddar. Hold on, let me get you cheddar.
We should probably mention that in the film it is acknowledged that Trader Joe's is the best spot to dumpster dive, in contrast to, I think he mentions Key Foods as being the place that you don't necessarily want to go. And during the actual dive at Trader Joe's, somebody says to another diver, if the fish isn't cold, don't eat it. Did you hear about anybody getting sick from the food they were pulling from the dumpster there?
Well, first, yes, Trader Joe's is sort of the best place, and it's the general rule to follow is the higher end the grocery store, the higher end their trash is. So, yes, Key Foods, Associated Market, these are sort of the lower end grocery stores in New York City, and generally the stuff they throw away should probably be left to be thrown away. But these places like Trader Joe's, Whole Foods, some of these smaller niche markets, they throw away some amazing stuff, and that's generally the place to go. Trader Joe's is so beloved because of the variety. You know, some places will just have bread, just produce, just this or that. Bakeries will have desserts, but Trader Joe's will have everything from eggs to produce to sea salts to, you know, spices to meats to sometimes beer I've even come across. I've actually never heard of anyone getting sick at all. Generally, the food that's thrown away is either at or past the expiration date by just one day. Some of the packaged foods have just a tear in them, or one of the eggs in the carton has cracked. And yet, you know, there's it's just common sense. It's no science. If something is molding, you don't eat it. If something, you know, stinks, like if something's rotting, you don't take it. And you know, I've never had any problems with getting sick or anything like that.
Alex, what about your habits? Do you dumpster dive? Have you tried any of this food?
You know, I was dumpster diving quite a bit. I think it was for almost 2 years before I even picked up the camera. I heard about it from a friend, and I said, you know, really? That's incredible. I got to see this for myself. And I went there, and sure enough, on the first day, I came home with $100 worth of high-end organic food. From then on, I was eating like a king.
Well, Alex Malis, head of Analect Films, director, photographer, and editor of the documentary Spoils, thank you so much for joining us and telling us about your adventure and making the film.
Anytime.
You can find links to his film at wordofmouthradio.org. First coined in 1984, cosplay has grown in popularity from a fringe convention pastime to a performance art form, inspiring thriving real-world and online social networks, and even competitions like the World Cosplay Summit. Now, photographer Anna Fisher is looking to take the role-playing subculture even further outside the convention center walls of Comic-Con to a whole other level, the great outdoors. Her Kickstarter project is called The Wild Places, and she joins us today from her home in Brooklyn to tell us about it. Anna, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
So for listeners who aren't part of this world, how would you define cosplay?
The word cosplay comes from the terms costume and play. But it's a subculture where people dress usually as characters from media like comic books or anime or movies. And then they gather together to, you know, hang out, do different kinds of activities. Some are performers. Sometimes they just like to party. And they all get together at large conventions.
Now, I understand there are even some sort of celebrities in the cosplayer world. This is a real community of people, and there are people who are really good at it.
There are thousands of cosplayers, surprisingly. We kind of walk among you unseen in our daily lives. But, yeah, there are some people who have become very well-known as cosplayers and have moved into a sort of cosplay professional field, which is a growing area right now.
Okay, so your project is to take these cosplayers who are, you know, typically in convention halls and sort of hotel hallways and outside of ballrooms at these conventions and bring them outside to photograph them. What are you hoping to accomplish with this project?
Oh, God, so many things. So I'm hoping that in the wild places, we can kind of break out of the spaces that cosplay has traditionally been seen, but also to sort of elevate cosplay and kind of showcase it in a way that makes it more accessible to the public. I think right now, cosplay is not very visible outside of the community. I'd like to change that. I'm also hoping to kind of connect cosplay photography, which right now is its own sort of weird island, to the larger discourse of photography and art photography, and very especially the American tradition of photography. I mean, I think that maybe they seem a little strange at first, but the truth is that a lot of these cosplayers are school teachers and are doctors, and you probably know some cosplayers in your life but aren't aware of it. And then they have this other life that is sort of magical, that is sort of a step outside of reality. And I'd like to, you know, bridge the two aesthetically without sort of breaking the illusion of cosplay.
Well, I'm interested in that role of cosplay photographer. You have people playing characters. You are looking at them through your camera lens. How do you see them differently or the same as a photographer would look at a different kind of model, say a fashion model or somebody doing an art photo?
It's totally different, actually, with cosplay. I do some fashion and I do a lot of fashion reportage in sort of my daily life and my job. But with cosplayers, it's far more collaborative because they're sort of styling themselves and sort of inventing themselves as that character. You sort of have a lot more give and take with the subject than you would with a model that you paid to come in and wear, like, you know, some coat for a lookbook for 2 hours. With the cosplayers, this is really, like, a significant part of their lives. And so when you work with them, you have to kind of be respectful of that and, like, aware of that in the space. And they sort of come out a lot more, and I think they come through the photograph more than a traditional model would.
So who are you going to be photographing for this project, and where will you be taking them?
Okay, so we're going to go out, and we're going to start in Phoenix, Arizona, and we're going to go over the course of 6 days up to Utah and then back again. On the project right now, we have a lot of cosplayers, but I can just run through. We have Vampy, right, who some of you may know, Dandelion's Wish, Stella Chu, Dr. Tang, Electric Lady, Jonin K, Uxie, Owl Depot, Jessica Nigiri, and Amy. And we actually have a few others who haven't been announced yet.
You have a couple of unusual perks planned for your Kickstarter backers. I think that there's one that you sort of mentioned in your video as being your favorite. Can you tell us about that one?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're going to shoot 2 disposable cameras that we will not process. So I'm going to shoot them. The cosplayers are going to shoot them. Everyone on the trip is going to snap a couple of photos with these disposable cameras. And then we're going to mail them out unprocessed. And so they can choose to keep that to themselves or to share that. That's really up to them, but they'll have this sort of unique experience that is completely theirs. Like, not even the people on the trip will know how it turns out.
Anna Fisher, a Brooklyn-based photographer behind the Kickstarter project The Wild Places. Her goal is to take cosplayers out of their convention hall element and photograph them in America's great outdoors. Anna, thanks so much for joining us and telling us about it.
Thank you for having me.
We have links to more on the project and a gallery of photos of some of our favorite cosplayers at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for spending some time with us today. If you missed any of the program or just want to hear something again, head over to wordofmouthradio.org, where you can listen to past segments or share them with friends. Special thanks to Taylor Quimby, Zach Nugent, and Logan Shannon for their work this week. They've made this job, I don't know, kind of easy. I'm Rebecca Lavoie. From all of us here at the program, have a great weekend. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Zach Nugent,
and Bill Barry.
And senior producer Rebecca Lavoie.
With plenty of help from our awesome interns,
Ali Kosmikas
and Logan Shannon.
Sarah Plord is our digital producer.
And Dan Colgan runs our board.
The views expressed in this program
are those of the individuals,
and not those of NHPR, its board of trustees,
or its underwriters.
To subscribe to our podcast
and listen to past shows, go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook and Tumblr.
Follow us on Twitter.
And check out a playlist of music from the program
on Spotify.
Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire
Public Radio.
Public Radio.